The Return of Chorb. The Kellers left the opera house at a late hour, in that Pacific German city, where the very air seemed a little lusterless and where a transverse row of ripples had kept shading gently the reflected cathedral for well over 7 centuries. Wagner was a leisurely affair presented with relish so as to overgorge one with music. After the opera, Keller took his wife to a smart nightclub renowned for its white wine. It was past 1 in the morning when their car, flippantly lit on the inside, sped through lifeless streets to deposit them at the iron wicket of their small but dignified private house. Keller, a thick-set old German, closely resembling Paul Kruger, was the first to step down on the sidewalk, across which the loopy shadows of leaves stirred in the street lamp's gray glimmer. For an instant his starched shirt front and the droplets of bugles trimming his wife's dress caught the light as she disengaged a stout leg and climbed out of the car in her turn. The maid met them in the vestibule and, still carried by the momentum of the news, told them, in a frightened whisper, about Chorb's having called. Frau Keller's chubby face, whose everlasting freshness somehow agreed with her Russian merchant-class parentage, quivered and reddened with agitation.
"He said she was ill?"
The maid whispered still faster. Keller stroked his gray brush of hair with his fat palm, and an old man's frown overcast his large, somewhat simian face with its long upper lip and deep furrows.
"I simply refuse to wait till tomorrow,"
muttered Frau Keller, shaking her head as she gyrated heavily on one spot, trying to catch the end of the veil that covered her auburn wig.
"We'll go there at once. Oh, dear, oh, dear! No wonder there's been no letters for quite a month."
Keller punched his gibus open and said in his precise, slightly guttural Russian,
"The man is insane. How dare he, if she's ill, take her a second time to that vile hotel?"
But they were wrong, of course, in thinking that their daughter was ill. Chorb said so to the maid only because it was easier to utter. In point of fact, he had returned alone from abroad and only now realized that, like it or not, he would have to explain how his wife had perished, and why he had written nothing about it to his in-laws. It was all very difficult. How was he to explain that he wished to possess his grief all by himself, without tainting it by any foreign substance, and without sharing it with any other soul? Her death appeared to him as a most rare, almost unheard-of occurrence. Nothing, it seemed to him, could be purer than such a death, caused by the impact of an electric stream, the same stream which, when poured into glass receptacles, yields the purest and brightest light. Ever since that spring day when, on the White Highway, a dozen kilometers from Nice, she had touched, laughing, the live wire of a storm-felled pole, Chorb's entire world ceased to sound like a world. It retreated at once, and even the dead body that he carried in his arms to the nearest village struck him as something alien and needless. In Nice, where she had to be buried, the disagreeable consumptive clergyman kept in vain pressing him for details. Chorb responded only with a languid smile. He sat day long on the shingly beach, cupping colored pebbles and letting them flow from hand to hand, and then, suddenly, without waiting for the funeral, he traveled back to Germany. He passed in reverse through all the spots they had visited together during their honeymoon journey. In Switzerland, where they had wintered and where the apple trees were now in their last bloom, he recognized nothing except the hotels. As to the black forest through which they had hiked in the preceding autumn, the chill of the spring did not impede memory. And just as he had tried on the southern beach to find again that unique rounded black pebble with the regular little white belt, which she had happened to show him on the eve of their last ramble, so now he did his best to look up all the roadside items that retained her exclamation mark, the special profile of a cliff, a hut roofed with a layer of silvery gray scales, a black fir tree, and a footbridge over a white torrent, and something which one might be inclined to regard as a kind of fatidic prefiguration, the radial span of a spider's web between two telegraph wires that were beaded with droplets of mist. She accompanied him. Her little boots stepped rapidly, and her hands never stopped moving, to pluck a leaf from a bush or stroke a rock wall in passing. Light, laughing hands that knew no repose. He saw her small face with its dense, dark freckles, and her wide eyes, whose pale greenish hue was that of the shards of glass licked smooth by the sea waves. He thought that if he managed to gather all the little things they had noticed together, if he recreated thus the near past, her image would grow immortal and replace her forever. Nighttime, though, was unendurable. Night imbued with sudden terror her irrational presence. He hardly slept at all during the 3 weeks of his trek, and now he got off, quite drugged with fatigue, at the railway station, which had been last autumn their point of departure from the quiet town where he had met and married her. It was around 8 o'clock of the evening. Beyond the houses, the cathedral tower was sharply set off in black against a golden-red stripe of sunset. In the station square stood in file the self-same decrepit fiacres. The identical newspaper seller uttered his hollow crepuscular cry. The same black poodle, with apathetic eyes, was in the act of raising a thin hind leg near a Morris pillar, straight at the scarlet lettering of a playbill announcing Parsifal. Chorb's luggage consisted of a suitcase and a big tawny trunk. A fiacre took him through the town. The cabbie kept indolently flapping his reins while steadying the trunk with one hand. Chorb remembered that she, whom he never named, liked to take rides in cabs. In the lane at the corner of the Municipal Opera House there was an old three-storied hotel of a disreputable type, with rooms that were let by the week or by the hour. Its black paint had peeled off in geographical patterns. Ragged lace curtained its bleary windows. Its inconspicuous front door was never locked. A pale but jaunty lackey led Chorb down a crooked corridor, reeking of dampness and boiled cabbage, into a room which Chorb recognized by the picture of a pink banlieue in a gilt frame over the bed, as the very one in which he and his wife had spent their first night together. Everything amused her then. The fat man in his shirt sleeves, who was vomiting right in the passage, and the fact of their having chosen by chance such a beastly hotel, and the presence of a lovely blonde hair in the wash-basin. But what tickled her most was the way they had escaped from her house. Immediately upon coming home from church, she ran up to her room to change, while downstairs the guests were gathering for supper. Her father, in a dress coat of sturdy cloth with a flabby grin on his apish face, clapped this or that man on the shoulder and served ponies of brandy himself. Her mother, in the meantime, led her closest friends, two by two, to inspect the bedroom meant for the young couple. With tender emotion, whispering under her breath, she pointed out the colossal eiderdown, the orange blossoms, the two pairs of brand-new bedroom slippers, large checkered ones, and tiny red ones with pompons that she had aligned on the bedside rug, across which a Gothic inscription ran, "We are together unto the tomb." Presently, everybody moved toward the hors d'oeuvre, and Chorb and his wife, after the briefest of consultations, fled through the back door. And only on the following morning, half an hour before the express train was to leave, reappeared to collect their luggage. Frau Keller had sobbed all night. Her husband, who had always regarded Chorb, destitute Russian émigré and littérateur, with suspicion, now cursed his daughter's choice, the cost of the liquor, the local police that could do nothing. And several times after the Chorbs had gone, the old man went to look at the hotel in the lane behind the opera house, and henceforward that black, purblind house became an object of disgust and attraction to him, like the recollection of a crime. While the trunk was being brought in, Chorb kept staring at the rosy chromo. When the door closed, he bent over the trunk and unlocked it. In a corner of the room, behind a loose strip of wallpaper, a mouse made a scuffling noise, and then raced like a toy on rollers. Chorb turned on his heel with a start. The light bulb hanging from the ceiling on a cord swayed ever so gently, and the shadow of the cord glided across the green couch and broke at its edge. It was on that couch that he had slept on his nuptial night. She, on the regular bed, could be heard breathing with the even rhythm of a child. That night he had kissed her once, on the hollow of the throat. That had been all in the way of lovemaking. The mouse was busy again. There exist small sounds that are more frightening than gunfire. Chorb left the trunk alone and paced the room a couple of times. A moth struck the lamp with a ping. Chorb wrenched the door open and went out. On the way downstairs, he realized how weary he was, and when he found himself in the alley, the blurry blue of the May night made him dizzy. Upon turning into the boulevard, he walked faster. A square. A stone Herzog. The black masses of the city park. Chestnut trees now were in flower. Then, it had been autumn. He had gone for a long stroll with her on the eve of the wedding. How good was the earthy, damp, somewhat violety smell of the dead leaves strewing the sidewalk. On those enchanting, overcast days, the sky would be of a dull white, and the small, twig-reflecting puddle in the middle of the black pavement resembled an insufficiently developed photograph. The gray stone villas were separated by the mellow and motionless foliage of yellowing trees, and in front of the Keller's house the leaves of a withering poplar had acquired the tone of transparent grapes. One glimpsed, too, a few birches behind the bars of the gate. Ivy solidly muffed some of their boles, and Chorb made a point of telling her that ivy never grew on birches in Russia, and she remarked that the foxy tints of their minute leaves reminded her of spots of tender rust upon ironed linen. Oaks and chestnuts lined the sidewalk. Their black bark was velveted with green rot. Every now and then a leaf broke away to fly athwart the street like a scrap of wrapping paper. She attempted to catch it on the wing by means of a child's spade found near a heap of pink bricks at a spot where the street was under repair. A little way off, the funnel of a worker's van emitted gray-blue smoke, which drifted aslant and dissolved between the branches, and a resting workman, one hand on his hip, contemplated the young lady, as light as a dead leaf, dancing about with that little spade in her raised hand. She skipped. She laughed. Chorb, hunching his back a bit, walked behind her, and it seemed to him that happiness itself had that smell, the smell of dead leaves. At present he hardly recognized the street, encumbered as it was with the nocturnal opulence of chestnut trees. A street lamp glinted in front. Over the glass a branch drooped, and several leaves at its end, saturated with light, were quite translucent. He came nearer. The shadow of the wicket, its checkerwork all distorted, swept up toward him from the sidewalk to entangle his feet. Beyond the gate and beyond a dim gravel walk loomed the front of the familiar house, dark except for the light in one open window. Within that amber chasm the housemaid was in the act of spreading with an ample sweep of her arms a snow-bright sheet on a bed. Loudly and curtly, Chorb called out to her. With one hand he still gripped the wicket, and the dewy touch of iron against his palm was the keenest of all memories. The maid was already hurrying toward him. As she was to tell Frau Keller later, what struck her first was the fact that Chorb remained standing silently on the sidewalk, although she had unlocked the little gate at once. "He had no hat," she related, "and the light of the street lamp fell on his forehead, and his forehead was all sweaty, and the hair was glued to it by the sweat. I told him master and mistress were at the theater. I asked him why he was alone. His eyes were blazing. Their look terrified me, and he seemed not to have shaved for quite a time. He said softly, 'Tell them that she is ill.' I asked, 'Where are you staying?' He said, 'Same old place,' and then added, 'That does not matter. I'll call again in the morning.' I suggested he wait, but he didn't reply and went away." Thus Chorb traveled back to the very source of his recollections, an agonizing and yet blissful test now drawing to a close. All there remained was but a single night to be spent in that first chamber of their marriage, and by tomorrow the test would be passed and her image made perfect. But as he trudged back to the hotel up the boulevard, where on all the benches in the blue darkness sat hazy figures, Chorb suddenly understood that, despite exhaustion, he would not be able to sleep alone in that room with its naked bulb and whispery crannies. He reached the square and plodded along the city's main avenue, and now he knew what must be done. His quest, however, lasted a long while. This was a quiet and chaste town, and the secret by-street where one could buy love was unknown to Chorb. Only after an hour of helpless wandering, which caused his ears to sing and his feet to burn, did he enter that little lane, whereupon he accosted at once the first girl who hailed him. "The knight," said Chorb, scarcely unclenching his teeth. The girl cocked her head, swung her handbag, and replied, 25. He nodded. Only much later, having glanced at her casually, Chorb noted with indifference that she was pretty enough, but considerably jaded, and that her bobbed hair was blonde. She had been in that hotel several times before, with other customers, and the wan, sharp-nosed lackey, who was tripping down as they were going upstairs, gave her an amiable wink. While Chorb and she walked along the corridor, they could hear, from behind one of the doors, a bed creaking, rhythmically and weightily, as if a log were being sawed in two. A few doors farther, the same monotonous creak came from another room, and as they passed by, the girl looked back at Chorb with an expression of cold playfulness. In silence, he ushered her into his room, and immediately, with a profound anticipation of sleep, started to tear off his collar from its stud. The girl came up very close to him. "And what about a small present?" she suggested, smiling. Dreamily, absent-mindedly, Chorb considered her, as he slowly grasped what she meant. Upon receiving the banknotes, she carefully arranged them in her bag, uttered a light little sigh, and again rubbed herself against him. "Shall I undress?" she asked with a shake of her bob.
"Yes. Go to bed," muttered Chorb. "I'll give you some more in the morning."
The girl began to undo hastily the buttons of her blouse and kept glancing at him askance, being slightly taken aback by his abstraction and gloom. He shed his clothes quickly and carelessly, got into the bed and turned to the wall. "This fellow likes kinky stuff," vaguely conjectured the girl. With slow hands, she folded her chemise, placed it upon a chair. Chorb was already fast asleep. The girl wandered around the room. She noticed that the lid of the trunk standing by the window was slightly ajar. By squatting on her heels, she managed to peep under the lid's edge. Blinking, and cautiously stretching out her bare arm, she palpated a woman's dress, a stocking, scraps of silk, all this stuffed in anyhow and smelling so nice that it made her feel sad. Presently she straightened up, yawned, scratched her thigh, and just as she was, naked, but in her stockings, drew aside the window curtain. Behind the curtain the casement was open, and one could make out, in the velvety depths, a corner of the opera house, the black shoulder of a stone Orpheus outlined against the blue of the night, and a row of light along the dim façade which slanted off into darkness. Down there, far away, diminutive dark silhouettes swarmed as they emerged from bright doorways onto the semicircular layers of illumined porch steps, to which glided up cars with shimmering headlights and smooth, glistening tops. Only when the breakup was over and the brightness gone, the girl closed the curtain again. She switched off the light and stretched on the bed beside Chorb. Just before falling asleep, she caught herself thinking that once or twice she had already been in that room. She remembered the pink picture on its wall. Her sleep lasted not more than an hour. A ghastly, deep-drawn howl roused her. It was Chorb, screaming. He had woken up some time after midnight, had turned on his side, and had seen his wife lying beside him. He screamed horribly, with visceral force. The white specter of a woman sprang off the bed. When, trembling, she turned on the light, Chorb was sitting among the tumbled bedclothes, his back to the wall, and through his spread fingers one eye could be seen burning with a mad flame. Then he slowly uncovered his face, slowly recognized the girl. With a frightened mutter, she was hastily putting on her chemise. And Chorb heaved a sigh of relief, for he realized that the ordeal was over. He moved onto the green couch and sat there, clasping his hairy shins and, with a meaningless smile, contemplating the harlot. That smile increased her terror. She turned away, did up one last hook, laced her boots, busied herself with the putting on of her hat. At this moment, the sound of voices and footsteps came from the corridor. One could hear the voice of the lackey repeating mournfully, "But look here, there's a lady with him." And an irate, guttural voice kept insisting, "But I'm telling you, she's my daughter." The footsteps stopped at the door. A knock followed. The girl snatched her bag from the table and resolutely flung the door open. In front of her stood an amazed old gentleman in a lusterless top hat, a pearl stud gleaming in his starched shirt. From over his shoulder peered the tear-stained face of a stout lady with a veil on her hair. Behind them, the puny, pale lackey strained up on tiptoe, making big eyes and gesturing invitingly. The girl understood his signs and shot out into the corridor past the old man, who turned his head in her wake with the same puzzled look and then crossed the threshold with his companion. The door closed. The girl and the lackey remained in the corridor. They exchanged a frightened glance and bent their heads to listen. But in the room, all was silence. It seemed incredible that inside there should be three people. Not a single sound came from there. "They don't speak," whispered the lackey, and put his finger to his lips.